from locking criminals up to lobbying for their rights and rehabilitation. Today's Bookmarks guest has gone from the police to Parliament to now prison reform advocate. Chester Burrows, the Honourable Chester Burrows, seems like an unlikely voice of justice reform from his beginnings as a 17-year-old police officer, but he's used his experiences to work out a way to better transform the lives of those who wind up on the wrong side of the law. And because it's Bookmarks, he's also got a big list of his books, music, movies and favourite art to share with us too. Hello there, Chester.
G'day, Jesse.
Thanks for your time today. Yeah, no, nice to meet you.
Well, it's always flattering when people want to know what you're thinking.
Yeah, well, I actually have really enjoyed looking through your list, so we'll get to it shortly. Can we just get the early part of your career first, though? Because people might be more familiar with you as a politician, but you began with the police, and why did you decide to join?
I'd always wanted to farm, and then it became that evident that that wasn't going to happen because no money and no land coming to me. My parents sort of said, look, you know, this is going to be real hard. And I was one of those really compliant kids because both mum and dad, if I'd said, no, this is what I really want to do, they would have said, okay, let's see how we can do that. But I just sort of took it that they didn't really want me to farm. So I thought about what I wanted to do, didn't want to, and what I didn't want to do. So my father came to me once and said, what are you going to do when you leave school? Because it's only the year after next, and you know, maybe you should go and be a plumber. And in my ignorance, I thought that all that meant was unblocking blocked toilets. And
yeah.
I decided I want to go and work outside. And then, probably thanks to programs like Zed Cars and Softly Softly, I thought the police was what I wanted to do, and initially be a police dog handler. So I went and inquired about that, and almost within a couple of weeks, I was accepted for an upcoming police cadet course, which in those days they recruited cadets at sort of 17, and you sort of started a very early police career.
Into sixth form, eh?
Yeah, yeah. It was quite a hard case, really. Well, you in those days you only went on to the seventh form or year 13 if you were going to go to university, and okay. I definitely wasn't, so there we go.
And how was police college? Was it at Porirua?
Yeah, yeah. No, it was at Trentham, actually, before the Porirua College was built. So all the barracks were temporarily built in 1914, and this was 1975. And it was hard case. It was a crucial time for a young, very wet behind the ears guy to go off and live with a whole lot of other testosterone-filled teenagers.
Yeah.
And so I sort of went there having never had a girlfriend, didn't smoke, didn't drink, and within a short period of time was a drinker and smoker and had my first girlfriend and having experiences that I'd never had before. So that was it was an interesting place to be. And I guess I was never a very good student, and I managed to scrape through and graduated bottom of the wing and that sort of stuff. But my forte was around practical stuff, not academic stuff. And I found it actually, I really enjoyed my police career, which ended up lasting 24 years. But in hindsight, there are things that make you cringe, and there was some interesting historical stuff to be part of.
Given your timing, were you involved in the Springbok protests?
Yeah, I went to a few of those games. The test in Auckland where the flower bombs were thrown down, and those. I was based in Nelson at that time, so there was the Nelson game, which I was taken onto the team to help organise, and then went to a game at Otago, and then two tests in Auckland and the match at Whangarei against Northland through the middle of the week.
As you were just talking earlier in the show about the Queen Street riots, that was 84, that would have been in your sort of period as well. You might not have been in Auckland, but do you recall the time?
Yeah, I wasn't in Auckland then, I was in Wellington or the Hutt Valley. But yeah, I certainly remember the time, and it was a really, or that, I remember watching the images on television around that. And just wondered if it was our country. But it wasn't too long after the Springbok tour, and so it wasn't the idea of the police being chased down the street by rioters and Vicky Verkey wasn't that old, given that the Springbok tour had only been in 81. But there was some of the, like, the, you know, Bastion Point, I wasn't involved in that either because I was stationed in another part of the country. But those sorts of things and the way we responded to protests around, say, visits by nuclear warships, that sort of stuff, was quite an interesting time to be in the police.
Now, was your family religious?
Yep. I don't like to think of it as religious because don't like religious people. But they, you know, they had Christian faith, and they were, I think my parents were excellent examples of how it should work.
You don't like religious people, but your first book you've chosen for me is the Bible.
Yeah, I like the bits of the Bible that I agree with and that fit in with my, like most Christians, fit in with my thinking on things. And
is that most Christians, or do most Christians read the Bible and form their beliefs on the basis of what's in there?
It's a little bit, I think it starts out that way, but as life catches up with people, they try and fit or justify their thoughts on life from Scripture, probably. Mm-hmm. And I know over the years I've changed significantly my views on things as they relate to my faith. And I think I recognise more and more that the Bible was written in a certain context, which, although a lot of it has current-day application, there's a whole lot that doesn't.
What's the stuff you enjoy in there?
I like the stuff around principles of justice and fairness and those sorts of things, finding the good in people. I love the passages about overturning conventional thinking, you know, the way that Jesus spoke about the Pharisees being a brood of vipers, tossing his toys in the temple and those sorts of things, which tend to really challenge commonly held and widely held views by, say, conservative Christians, and actually challenges people to think a little bit more broadly on issues such as, such as gay marriage or the place of women in society and those sorts of things, the place of children and the elevation of children and how they should colour all our thinking and the way we actually live out our faith in terms of Christian church, but how we should also do politics. And I think the other thing that I really enjoy about the Bible is how it is absolutely clear that Jesus was a politician, was very good at politics, and knew how to play the game.
Do you ever worry that by talking about the Bible and admitting to your faith or talking about your faith that it'll, what's a good way of putting it, put people off you?
Oh, well, I don't worry about it so much anymore, but I certainly have previously and from time to time. I mean, people...
In New Zealand, I think you're encouraged to sort of play it down a bit, aren't you?
Yeah, you are, because New Zealand's very much a secular country. But it is interesting. People like to have Christians in a pigeonhole, which means, you know, narrow-minded fundamentalist haters. And in actual fact, the vast majority of people, because going to church is no longer in fashion, the vast majority of Christians who take their faith seriously are very broad-minded, open-minded, and giving to the community. And we'd be stuffed without them, actually.
So does your Bible have much in common with Israel Folau's Bible?
Well, the words are there, but we don't share the same views on a lot of those things. I tend to think that people like Israel run around measuring people's relationship with God, and I don't see that that's any of my business. I've got enough to worry about with my own. And I don't like the finger pointing. It's not scriptural, but there's a little saying that whenever you point the finger at someone, there's three pointed back at you. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that my life would bear that much scrutiny if I took on the sort of mantra that Israel does.
You decided to actually publicly denounce those comments of his. Denounce is a bit of a pompous word, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Disagree with.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. What bothers me, I guess, and I think it bothers a lot of Christians, is when someone who outwardly declares their faith and goes and says things that really embarrasses you, you all end up with egg on your face and you end up trying to justify why this guy is saying that. And I just don't want to get into those battles. But it was really interesting because I'm doing a bit of lay preaching now, and I was taking a service at Kaponga, and after he had made those comments, and we talked about it as part of my address, and it was amazing the number of people in the service later on who sort of thanked me for putting some sort of clothes on these bald statements and recognising that actually you don't have to buy into that level of hatred.
Just got a message from someone listening who says this, as a late middle-aged Christian, they are challenging themselves to find out for themselves what's in the books that constitute the Bible, because they've noticed that no two Christians are the same. Do you go back to the Bible very often and read it?
I tend to read it more now in preparation for services I'm taking. I've just taken up a new role where I'm doing that a lot more often. And so that's that. I haven't been a very avid reader of scripture. I was sort of a daily readings type of person, and I sort of knock myself around a bit for that because I should have more of it at the front of my head, and I don't. But no, at the moment I read more about and listen to more of what people commenting on what's being written rather than trying to read it from cover to cover or bite off big chunks of scripture in any one sitting.
Have you been enjoying the preaching?
Yeah, I have. It's sort of, I mean, I think when I was in Parliament, I got away from it a bit because you just get so busy. I was probably in church most Sundays or lots of Sundays, but I also enjoyed plenty of Sundays doing something completely different. But this has been quite good to sort of focus back on what I really think about some of the things and recognise how I've changed my views and stuff.
I'm speaking with former MP, the Honourable Chester Burrows, and he's in for Bookmarks. If you signed up for politics again, would you still sign up for the National Party?
Well, I'm still a member, so I suppose I'll say yes. It's an interesting one because the parties change, and you know, you get someone who says, oh, I could never vote anything but Labour because, you know, my old grandfather would roll over in his grave. The Labour Party today bears no resemblance to the Labour Party that the grandfather voted for, and same with the National Party. And you know, there are other parties that I've got a lot of sympathy for, such as the Maori Party. So I guess if I was heading back into it, I probably would, but John Key told me once that I was the National Party's lefty and that we needed one. So he was happy for me to be the National's lefty. I was accused of being in the wrong party by both parties, so nothing changes too much.
Well, and presumably he's talking about your views on restorative justice. Does someone who believes in restorative justice and alternative punishments have to be a lefty, though?
No, because
to me it seems like a sort of, you know, it seems like an evidence-based approach.
Yeah, it's totally evidence-based, and it's suffered for some bad press, but there are some, mainly by people who have a much more punitive view or enjoy a much more punitive view of the justice system and how it should be. But actually,
It does the right a disservice, doesn't it, to say that if you're on the right, you're more on the reactionary, unthinking, emotive side of things.
Yeah, that's right. Because actually parties of all colours have used the law and order button while they're in opposition coming up to an election in order to win votes. Mm-hmm. So actually neither side of politics owns the criminal justice system or justice at all. And they don't own restorative justice either. But restorative justice is something that's been done all around the world in most Western countries, and it's having a very good effect. And all studies show that offenders who go through the restorative justice process are far less likely to go on and offend than if they hadn't.
We might come back to that. For now, though, it's probably time we played some music, and you're the DJ Chester. We're going to start with some Chris Christopherson. Where does he fit into your life?
He was someone I discovered at about 15 years of age, and my mate that I used to sit next to in quite a few classes had recently discovered him, and so he was sort of, we were talking a lot about his music. And so I became an avid fan really quickly. And I just love the way that he took country music away from, you know, dogs and horses and bars and stuff and went down a far more contemporary line and talked about the dirty stuff like, you know, drugs and alcohol and injustice and racism and prejudice and those sorts of things. And I like the rhythm of country music. And Chris Christopherson sort of dragged it kicking and screaming into, you know, the contemporary themes of the 50s and 60s.
Have you seen him live?
Yeah, I've seen him twice. Unfortunately, I left it really late, so I saw him when he was here just a few months ago, and I saw him about 5 years ago, and he's 83 now, and he's old, but you can tell that, you know, the poet's still there. I wish I'd gone much earlier in the day and heard him when he was a lot younger on his earlier tours. But yeah, he's certainly still got it. And the last concert I went to was in the Michael Fowler Centre. It was really well attended, and his contemporary songs got just as much grunt to them as the earlier stuff.
Let's play Best of All Possible Worlds. This is Chris Christopherson.
I was running through the summer rain, trying to catch the evening train and kill that old familiar pain, weaving through my tangled brain. But when I tipped my bottle back, I smacked into a cop I didn't see. That policeman said, "Mr. Cool, if you ain't drunk, then you're a fool." I said, "If that's against the law, tell me why I never saw a man locked in that jail of yours who wasn't just as low down poor as me." Well, that was when someone turned out the lights, and I wound up in jail to spend the night and dream of all the whining lonely girls in this best of all possible worlds. Well, I woke up next morning feeling like my head was gone and like my thick old tongue was licking something sick and wrong. And I told that man I'd sell my soul, something wet and cold is that old cell. That kindly jailer grinned at me, all eaten up with sympathy, then poured himself another beer and came and whispered in my ear, "If booze was just a dime a bottle, boy, you couldn't even buy the smell." I said I knew there was something I liked about this town, but it takes more than that to bring me down, 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 'cause there's still a lot of wine and lonely girls in this best of all possible worlds. Well, they finally came and told me they was gonna set me free, and I'd be leaving town if I knew what was good for me. I said it's nice to learn that everybody's so concerned about my health. I said I won't be leaving no more quicker than I can, 'cause I've enjoyed about as much of this as I can stand, and I don't need this town of yours more than I never needed nothing else, 'cause there's still a lot of drinks that I ain't drunk, lots of pretty thoughts that I ain't thunk. Oh yeah, Lord, there's still so many lonely girls in this best of all possible worlds.
RNZ National, Best of All Possible Worlds from Chris Christopherson. I'm talking to Chester Burrows, the Honourable Chester Burrows, former MP, who's in for bookmarks. What are you most proud of in your political career, Chester?
I think probably the move to have DNA taken from every arrested person, because previous to that, if you want to take DNA off somebody, had to go and get a warrant on every occasion. So now we recognise that DNA is just a modern fingerprint, and when someone gets arrested and charged, they have a fingerprint photograph and a DNA sample which is kept record of. And what that means is that whenever anybody leaves hair, blood, semen, saliva, skin at a scene, they can be identified. And I think that little thing will probably save more victims than any other single piece of legislation that we might pass, because a lot of our more horrific and notorious offenders who have gone on to have many, many victims would have been picked up a lot earlier if that had been available at the time. Their DNA had already been on record.
Was it hard to get through, or was it an idea whose time had come?
I think it probably was an idea whose time had come. We brought it in as part of the sort of 100-day plan when National came into government in 2008, and it was pretty difficult to argue against it, and I think everyone except the Greens voted for it. I can't remember precisely.
You were there for 12 years. Are you sort of happy with your legacy in Parliament?
Well, I think every parliamentarian wants to do more and thinks that they were overlooked for other stuff and they could have done a better job than someone else sitting in the chair that they really wanted to sit in. But quite honestly, it took me 3 goes to get into Parliament, so I had 2 losses before I finally won in 2005. And if anyone had lined me up and said, look, you'll campaign for 3 elections before you win, you'll have you'll be police spokesman opposition for 3 years, then you'll be chairman of the Justice Select Committee and transact more legislation than the other select committee for 3 years, then you'll be a minister for 3 years, courts and associate justice and welfare, and then you'll be deputy speaker for 3 years, and then you'll leave, I would have said, yep, that'll do me. So in hindsight, I wish I'd managed to be a minister in cabinet instead of minister outside of cabinet and some of those things. But nevertheless, it was a career that I really enjoyed and a privilege that not many people get.
Were you always a reader? Did you always enjoy books?
No, I didn't actually. I didn't like reading much as a kid, and I was quite a slow reader. Probably not by definition, but I read slowly and didn't. I'd rather do stuff than read stuff. And it was discovering a few books early on that really sort of kicked off a bit of a passion. And now I always have a book on the go, even if I'm sort of chewing my way through it fairly slowly. And I think that's sort of what turned it on for me, was finding books that articulated the stuff that I was interested in.
And early on you discovered A Good Keen Man by Barry Crump.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that just, it was right at a time when I was just starting to spend more time in the bush and doing a lot more tramps and that sort of thing. And he just, that Good Keen Man just was so colourful in its writing. It just really created images and things that I really enjoyed. And funnily enough, years later, as an MP, I had to go to a little school and talk about books and what my favourite book was and take a book along, and I took that book, and there was a little kid there who was about 10 who also had A Good Keen Man, and I said, what's it you really like about this book? And he said, it just sort of takes you out of yourself. I couldn't have said it better.
Yeah,
it was great.
Tell me about this other one, I Shall Not Die, Tito Kuaru's War by James Bellich.
Yeah, someone recommended I read this book not long after I'd come to work in South Taranaki. It's all about Tito Kuaru, who was an incredible warrior from Ngaruhine in South Taranaki, and of course in the land wars. And it's all about the places where I live and have for the last just over 30 years. But we hear nothing about this, and thankfully with change in policy, our kids will learn about this stuff at school. But as a result of Te Toko Waru and the battles, you know, Taranaki was very close to being a separate Maori state, and he was one battle away from creating that circumstance. He became a master guerrilla warfare, having tangata whenua up trees, digging rifle pits, creating sap lines, throwing up paths in a matter of days, creating incredibly difficult paths to attack. And he had quite a movement follow him, and he was amazing. James Bellich, in the telling of this story and the injustices of it, it's an incredibly moving story. Another interesting thing about Te Toko Waru was he was converted to Methodism early on and was a very staunch member of the Methodist Church, and had sort of taken a vow of pacifism until the government just overtook all the agreements around the sale and purchase of land and those sorts of things, and started settling in places where they had no right to do so. And he said about chucking the settlers off. But he wrote letters to the newspaper saying that he had developed a taste for human flesh, and he was winding people up, and the papers couldn't save themselves from printing it. And so he created a real aura around himself.
You mentioned Taranaki as your home. You're in Hawera, I think, and a chance to give a plug for a lesson on museum up there.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know about this museum, but it's the Tawhiti Museum. It's in an old dairy factory just outside of Hawera, and it's the work of Nigel and Teresa Ogle. Nigel was an art teacher at Hawera High School, and as a hobby, he bought this dairy factory and then turned it into a museum, and it's just grown from there. So a lot of the displays are around colonisation and land wars and musket wars and those sorts of things. And his forte is diorama. So these may involve models only a couple of centimetres tall to actually life-size models. And it's just absolutely fascinating. He has received a number of tourism awards, but it's time to recognise him. He's probably done more for education and understanding around colonial periods in New Zealand than many. And it's a great place to go and visit, where you can actually get a sense of the history, and then you can quite easily, especially in South Taranaki, just drive a couple of K down the road and see the landforms that are still there, and to get some understanding of what was happening at the time.
Do I have this right? Is there an Elvis Museum in Hawera too?
Yep, there certainly is. It's owned by one of our local guys called Kevin Wosley, and he's got it in his garage, and it's absolutely fascinating, and it's amazing to see the people who have been and had a look at it. But yeah, anyone in Hawera should go and have a visit to Katie Wosley's Elvis Museum.
Okay, I've got a text from Tom. I'm going to read it to you because I think you can handle it. Please ask your guests about the idea that faith, i.e., and by the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with the Honourable Chester Burrows, and we talked earlier about his Christian faith earlier in the interview. Yes, please ask your guest about the idea that faith, i.e. belief without evidence, is a compromising principle to have in your head, often resulting in the Israel Folau type of thinking, and that all of the good ethical stuff found in the Bible is also found in secular literature and thought as well, indicating that people don't need the Bible and its attendant nasty bits in order to behave well. I think Tom makes that point pretty eloquently, don't you, Chester?
Yeah, I think, there's two or three things to say there. You frequently don't have faith in anything until you've tested it and found it to be true for yourself anyway. So that's one thing. I wouldn't have faith to sit on a piece of one-by-one string between a couple of posts and think that it would hold me up. But I would on a 4x2, and I'd have more faith in a 2x6. The other thing is, I never suggested, I don't think anyone does, that Christianity's got the monopoly on good behaviour, and there's plenty of good virtues and principles that are attributed as sort of Christian virtues that are replicated in lots of other religions, and I don't have any issue with that. And also, it's there are also happen to be good codes that secular people live by. So I'm not trying to say that the Christian faith has got a monopoly on anything that's any good. But I'm just saying that it contains a number of helpful things for me in the life that I live, and the truths that I've found.
I guess his point is that not everyone is as discriminating and critical thinking as you, and if you're encouraging people to go to the Bible, there might be others who might find something more useful in a different book that doesn't have the good and the bad.
Yep, and I don't care. If they find them, fine. You know, I'm long past the one true religion thing, I've got friends of many faiths and friends with no faith, and they live good lives, and frequently we abide by the same principles. And as I said before, it's not my job to measure or judge anybody.
You drink alcohol?
Yep, sometimes too much, but I do enjoy a drink, that's right.
It's a bit of a random question, but I was just thinking about it in terms of the Christianity, but also in terms of Parliament, where I imagine it's easy to sort of drop into unhealthy lifestyles.
Yeah, it is, and it's just everywhere. And I think I sort of confronted some of those things. Doesn't stop me having a drink now, but at the same time, it's probably not the healthiest thing as far as alcohol goes to stay in Parliament too long. But other people have got far more resolve than me, and plenty of the senior members who have been in Parliament a lot longer than me had a better handle on that stuff.
Tell us about your painting, Chester. When did you take it up?
Well, I painted a lot as a kid, and my dad was an artist. He was a display artist in a department store, so he was a very creative guy. He also wrote and did all sorts of things.
Gee, what an interesting guy. He was a farmer and an artist.
No, I wasn't a farmer. He grew up on a farm, but he wasn't a farmer.
Okay, sorry. I thought you were talking about you taking over the farm from him.
Yeah, no.
As you were.
And so I painted a lot as a kid, and I really enjoyed that, into sort of teenage years. And then I just got busy with life. I always did a bit of cartooning and that sort of stuff and took the piss out of work colleagues and things like that. And then, funnily enough, when I became a Member of Parliament, one of the Altruza or Zonta or something in Whanganui was raising money and gave a number of people a 12x12 canvas and asked them to paint something on it, and they were going to sell them. And so I did a painting that I'd of a local scene and really enjoyed it, was happy with the result, gave it to the lady, and unbeknown to me, as I walked out the office, she decided to put it in the window, and someone walked in off the street and bought it in about 3 minutes and paid $150 for it. And I thought, well, there's several little endorsements that the painting was worth something there. I really enjoyed it, so I'm going to take it seriously. And that was about 2006, I suppose, and I've just been into it ever since.
What do you like to paint?
I like painting what you'd call contemporary landscape. So it's contemporary impressionism. So it's sort of it's indicating, not detailing. So it's not photographic, and it's more about capturing the light as it moves across the landscape, that sort of thing.
But it is of something.
Yeah. I'm not. I'd like to have a crack at abstract stuff, but I'm doing this at the moment, and I just want to. I want to get better at it. And so I want to concentrate on that before I go exploring a whole lot of other things.
Where could people see it? Do you have a Chester Burrows Instagram?
No, I've got a website with, I think, two or three paintings on it, but I'm not servicing the website very well, so there might be.
You should just get on Instagram, Chester. I know it's, it seems like it's for a younger generation, but for someone like a painter or someone who wants to share images easily and, people to find you, it'd be the way to go.
Yeah.
It's not for me to tell you what to do.
Well, you're probably right. I've signed up and I watch look at other people's paintings, but I haven't put any of mine up there yet. But
you know what you're called? A lurker.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
How appropriate.
To name another artist that you enjoy, Brett Garling.
Yeah, Brett Garling is an Australian sculptor, but he paints, and he's an incredible guy, actually. He's one of these multi-talented people, and I've spent a bit of time with him. And actually, when I turned 60, my wife contacted him and said, my husband's following you, and can we arrange a workshop or something like that? And he was coming out to New Zealand, and so he invited me along to paint with him and a number of others. There's about 10 of us. But he's got an incredible ability to put atmosphere in the landscape. He lives in absolutely drought-stricken New South Wales, just out of Dubbo at the moment. And a lot of his paintings are really sort of smoky, hazy, and that sort of stuff. But again, he's a sort of landscape impressionism. And we both got to know each other through another guy called John Crump, who's probably our most famous or prolific, has been the most prolific plein air artist, and he's been wonderful encouragement to me as well, and it's amazing. We don't actually honour our artists as well as we should, because they do a fantastic job for us as a country.
It's been a pleasure meeting you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's been an honour.
We're going to finish with a bit of Peter, Paul and Mary. Why have you chosen this song?
It's on this sort of social conscience theme, I suppose. It was introduced to me by my Standard 4 teacher, which is going back to about 1968. And it was right at the time, New Zealand was involved in the Vietnam War. We were voting as a country around things like 10 o'clock closing. There was protests against the Americans. There was a lot of... This was not long around Martin Luther King's assassination, not long after Kennedy's assassination. Racism was a big thing. And so this teacher just took us into thinking beyond ourselves, and this is one that I've always appreciated.